On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, Pete Crow Armstrong is making Shohei Ohtani sweat. Is this a real conversation for NL MVP? What a series it was between the Cubs and Dodgers. Cubs sweeping the defending champs. Dodgers have lost six in a row. But let's not forget about Ohtani too fast. Then we open up the mailbag, read some of your emails, including all kinds of conspiracy theories. We love those. And then, of course, it's Friday. So we give you the good, the bad, the ugly. Oh, my goodness, that White Sox-Red Sox game. How about Jeffrey on leaping to the sky? Kevin Gausman's five-year-old said, what? And so much more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that thinks MVP should stand for most valuable person. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And who cares how many homers you hit? It's about if you're a good person. You good guy.
Yeah, I mean, you could do both, right? That's allowed. Sure. You could go ahead and be, I don't know what percentage of MVPs in baseball history have been great people. We do like to often talk about one of the worst and funniest cliches is when people talk about how, man, you know, he's a great player, but he is an even better person. And we routinely say the odds of that being true for the best baseball players on earth is quite small.
It's improbable, borderline impossible. If Shohei Ohtani is the best baseball player on the planet, he is not the best person on the planet. I refuse to believe. Maybe he's a good person, but is he the best person? None of the players are even better people, or any of the players in the top 0.00001% of people on the planet. Maybe, but maybe not. On today's episode, we will talk about the Most Valuable Person Award in the National League, PCA versus Ohtani. That's our opener. Let's get into it. Pete Crow Armstrong and Shohei Ohtani squared off one-on-one. They played one-on-one baseball this week at Wrigley Field as the Cubs took all three games against the Los Angeles Dodgers, who have now lost six in a row in the final game of that three-game set, which transpired on Wednesday afternoon after we recorded. Both Ohtani and PCA ripped two home runs. The NL MVP race is heating up. We're going to use this as an opportunity to discuss Mr. Crow Armstrong, how he relates to Ohtani, and who should be the NL MVP today, August 7th.
Yeah, I think we should just settle it right now. And I have no interest in watching these guys play any more baseball the rest of the season. I think now is the time to settle it and just be done with this so we don't have to talk about it anymore. I really want to focus on PCA more than Ohtani. Now, Ohtani will say that Ohtani is, there was a little, as always, he has like one bad week and everyone's like, oh no, he's bad at hitting and he can't pitch. This guy sucks now. He's leading the NL in OPS. Let's not worry too much. Sure, his slugging percentage is not over 600 the way that it was last year, but he is still having a marvelous offensive season. And we know what he did on the mound before his knee started hurting. But we'll get back to Ohtani in a second. Let's focus on PCA because the season that he's having, the run that the Cubs are having, what a week for them. Not only sweeping the Dodgers, but then yesterday playing a very strange makeup game against the Blue Jays in which Alex Bregman hit a dramatic game-tying home run. And then PCA stole third and the throw got away and was the winning run in extra innings. I just think that the season that PCA is having, how much better he has gotten. Because remember, even last year, over the first half of the season, we know Ohtani was doing his thing, but we were already having pretty similar thoughts about the possibility of PCA at his best being in an MVP conversation someday. Then he just completely falls off a cliff in the second half, and we're like, all right, let's see what he can do this year. And this year, it is not just, okay, now he's doing what he was doing in the first half last year. He is a better baseball player. He is a better hitter. And that is what I'm so impressed about and what I hope that people are really recognizing, that this is not just a similar hot streak to last year. This guy has improved.
This is a different player. It's a different hitter. And this first half of last year felt fluky. It felt like a hot streak. He felt like he was getting the ball in the air a lot, which was a good thing, but the chase and whiff rates felt unsustainable And when the season tumbled off a cliff after the All-Star game, I wouldn't say people were surprised. This go around, he is straight up, forget his elite defense, he is one of the most productive hitters in the entire sport. Like, he is one of the best hitters in the world right now. His stats as we sit here today: 289, 386, 550, with a 937 OPS, 26 homers, and 29 steals. The most impressive part of his season, and the part that has allowed him to take this leap, is that he has cut his chase rate by 7.5%. Again, 7.5% less often he is swinging at pitches outside the zone. That is the single biggest drop for any player in the sport this season compared to last year. That is a preposterously difficult thing to pull off, and in my opinion, is the number one reason why PCA has elevated his game.
Yeah, and he's still striking out a lot, right? I mean, a 26% strikeout rate is still there. To me, it's not just that he's not chasing, he's just not swinging. The swing rate has dropped even more, and this is something that there is actually another player, the other player closest to have kind of mirroring this, who has also elevated his game in a very similar way, is Junior Caminero, who has also basically doubled, maybe even tripled his walk rate in the same way that PCA has. But the last two seasons, his overall swing rate on all pitches was 60%. Now it's down to 49%. So it seems that he's come into the season recognizing. Now he's seeing about the same number of pitches in the zone, slightly fewer. I imagine that pitchers are starting to make an adjustment, being like, all right, this guy can do damage. But the batted ball profile, which you alluded to briefly, is still intact. And that is a skill change that it did feel like was an adjustment he really did make last year and was ultimately undone by his approach in the second half. But pulling the ball in the air, he is doing it as well as anybody in the league right now, over 30% pulled fly ball rate. That was true last year. That is true this year. That's where the power has really come in. He's also just gotten stronger and he's hitting the ball harder. But his ability to just chase, it's still a bad chase rate, right? If you look at his Baseball Savant sliders, it's 24th percentile. Like, he is still chasing more out of the zone than most hitters. But last year, he was second percentile, right? And the walk rate was fourth percentile. He was never drawing free passes. And for him to just be able to stand there a little bit more often and be a little bit more selective, the whole story of PCA becoming an MVP candidate is going from, I have this floor of, I'm the best center fielder in the league, and so I am going to be providing defense and also base running impact, that like, that is there. So that is there. So how much better can I get from this incredibly high floor? And for him to find strength gains and hit the ball harder, for him to improve his batted ball profile and pull the ball in the air, and now to upgrade his plate discipline, it's no surprise that the dude's tracking for a 10 WAR season, because the floor was already so high. It's just amazing how much better he's been able to get so quickly. And that is why we are now going to be having a real conversation, because his offensive numbers are at least comparable to Ohtani, and he's bringing a whole lot more to the table, even if he is not pitching. So that is my PCA introduction, I suppose. But is there anything else you want to focus on him in particular before we open it up to the MVP conversation?
I think it's just a worthwhile example of how and why players get better, and when we as media or the public or fans try and contextualize them or try and kind of like take a snapshot of where they're at a specific point in time. Like, the player that PCA was last year was so volatile, and you could kind of see it if you watched him. That being said, even in the second half, it was like, this guy doesn't suck. Like, no one's giving up on this player who's 23 years old. Now, PCA 24, outrageous athlete, strong work ethic, track record of offensive performance. That's the type of guy you're just going to bet on time after time, and is a good reminder of development not always being linear, and development being a long story that can happen at the big league level. I mean, this is what, PCA's parts of four big league seasons. Like, it doesn't happen right away. But with a guy this athletic, this driven, we're not particularly surprised. Now, does he have a shot at the MVP? Answer is yes. when Ohtani went down a month ago with his knee issue and has not pitched since, we had a conversation here where I was like, I think PCA can crawl his way into this conversation. You somewhat disagreed. I think we're now at a point where it is a legitimate debate. I don't think there is a wrong answer. I think that you will, there is obviously a chance one of these two dudes is going to pull away over the next 2 months. There's a lot of baseball left to play. But with 7 weeks left in the season, PCA is right there, man.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think that he has, he's put himself in an interesting position for us to have a genuinely interesting debate, I would say, which is, now I think just jumping ahead and assuming that they're going to have similar batting lines at the end of the season, I think that is a little bit too aggressive for now when you consider both players' offensive
I agree.
Track records and the possibility
However,
that his chase issues still at least lead him to a colder stretch at some point down the stretch. But I agree that it is plausible that they will have comparable batting lines at the end of the year. That is true.
And they do right now. And that is what is so striking is how similar they are, where Ohtani's got a 954, PCA's got a 937. If you go by WRC plus or OPS plus and you do park adjusted stuff, it's almost identical, those numbers. And so if you say, what are PCA and Ohtani doing when they step in the batter's box? It is about even. That's a wash, which is super convenient, in my opinion, because then you get into this really interesting ideological debate about what is valuable, right? So crumple up the hitter, cancel them out, and forget about it. What you are comparing at this point is Ohtani's 85 and two-thirds elite innings on the mound, 179 ERA, 95 strikeouts, and 85.2. I mean, that is one of the best pitchers
elite.
In the world.
No, right. It's not just like
elite.
He had 14 good starts, right? He was right there as one of the 3 to 5 best pitchers in the league.
Sure.
For 14 starts.
On a rate basis, as good as anybody at pitching. Again, that is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
He hits two. Never let that numb you. You're comparing that against PCA's second position, which is center field. Now, PCA is not just elite at center field. He's not just elite at defense. He is the single most valuable defensive player in the sport by a significant margin. There is an argument that few players in the history of baseball have been this good at defense. Now, advanced statistics, even in 2026, are not the most reliable thing in the world. If you're going to go and compare that to like Ozzie Smith, who knows, right? But based on what we have and the eye test, Pete Crow Armstrong is as good at defense as anybody in our lifetimes, Jordan. I think that is a indisputable fact. So then what you're comparing is Ohtani's on-mound abilities and PCA's abilities on defense. How valuable are they? If you look at WAR, which is a part of the conversation, the answer is pretty comparable. And then the edge, if you think that those are comparable, the edge then goes to PCA because he has 29 steals. Ohtani has 6. He is a better base runner, a more valuable base runner. That is a fact right now. And so if I was voting today, I think I would vote for Pete.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, the steals are relevant, kind of. To me, I don't think that would end up being the tiebreaker. Like, I would just kind of decide whether I'm more impressed with one or the other and just lean into the philosophical debate that we're already talking about, which is the defense versus the pitching. I stand by saying that I am still more impressed by Ohtani for, I think, obvious reasons. I don't think I have to explain that because we've had all kinds of tremendous center fielders and like that.
Do you know who
that part I don't think
is impressed
would disagree with?
Yeah. You know who's impressed by Ohtani? Literally Pete Crow Armstrong. Pete Crow Armstrong, who, when asked about the MVP, this is from Jesse Rogers at ESPN, said, quote, "I'd be crazy to say I don't want to win an MVP, but if we're talking about priorities, I think mine are pretty straight. It's not on the forefront of my mind. It's fun to joke about, fun to acknowledge, and I think it's absolutely okay to pay attention to. But again, it's not like following me up to the plate. And yeah, I think if you guys want to talk about all this back and forth, I should really go get in the lab and start pitching. I really should." PCA understands that what Ohtani is doing is a fundamentally different accomplishment than what PCA is doing. Just because PCA's defense may or may not be more valuable than Ohtani's pitching, it is a harder combination of things to accomplish. It is a more unique duo of skill sets. And even PCA acknowledges that. The question then becomes, how much should that factor in to a vote?
Yeah, and it's interesting because we do now have a lot of different metrics that can tell us whether it's just fielding run value, whether it is WAR, that would tell you that the impact that they are having on their team is comparable. Or in this case right now, that PCA does have a significant edge and may continue to gain a significant edge as long as Ohtani is not pitching. You think about it, you say, okay, well, Ohtani pitched for 85 innings. That's 85 innings where he was really in control of the game in a way that no defender possibly can. But then you could say, all right, well, how does that compare to PCA spending 1,000 innings in center field, which he has so far? That number is only going to continue to grow. Not that he is making a difference on every single play, but we can tell that the number of plays he's made above average is so far ahead of the rest of the league that you can certainly make that argument. I think the last thing that I would say about this, and by the way, I love the PCA quote because I'm not surprised that he's entirely aware that, like, not that he's going to say don't vote for me, but he's also saying, let's be real here. I recognize what I'm doing is a little bit different. Ohtani was asked about it too. And he gave a quote that might not come off as much and maybe didn't mean to, convey anything, but it did make me think about something. Ohtani was asked about it. He's like, okay, you thinking about it? Oh, this PCA guy is really, he's coming for your MVP. You know, how many more? You sure you can win this thing again?
Ohtani did he said, talk quote, about the team?
Not really.
You talking about the team?
Yeah. What?
Oh, you talk about, did he? I bet he did. I bet Ohtani said he's going to talk about the team.
Well, he did, but he also said this. He said, not really. I'm not thinking about it. Quote, it's still too far away to think about that. For me, it's more important for the team to win. Okay.
Yep. There it is.
But I am intrigued by the quote, it's still a little too far away to think about that. I don't think that is a nothing quote. I don't think that is him saying, I'm definitely coming back to pitch. But I also am going to interpret that to say, let's not crown this kid yet. I'm him. I'm Shohei Ohtani. Watch me hit 17 home runs over the next, 2 months and also make two starts down the stretch where you remember that what I'm doing is something nobody else has ever done. I'm not saying that's definitely going to happen. I do think that narrative-wise, it is very much going to hurt if Ohtani, not even just like the numbers that we're comparing, if his pitching gets farther and farther in the rear view. Like if this season had happened in reverse, like the exact total ended up being the same. But if Ohtani finished the year with 85 innings like this, I really don't think we would be having this conversation, frankly. But I'm glad that we are where we're at because it is fun. And I think PCA has made it really interesting. But I think Ohtani saying it's still too far away to think about that tells me that he knows he still has time to win this thing, whether that means he's coming back to pitch or not.
We don't like betting. We don't like using that as the lens. But it is interesting to me that Ohtani is no longer the betting favorite. The PCA in a lot of those markets has passed him. I think that that's wrong. I think that if the season ended today, I would vote for PCA. But if I had to guess what's going to happen over the rest of the season, I would still say I think Ohtani will end up winning because there is another level that he can go to. Now, it all, in my opinion, revolves around the pitching stuff, both because if he comes back from pitching and makes a couple starts, that will remind us that he is the thing that does this. But the other thing is like, okay, the energy it takes him to be good at pitching is pretty significant. I would not be surprised if he goes on a heater because he does not need to spend energy on the mound over the next couple of weeks, that he can kind of lock in on hitting. We've seen that, 2024, when Ohtani locked in on hitting and he went 50-50, just the so funny he doesn't run anymore, right? He's just like, I did that. Like, I don't need to do that anymore. It's fine.
Right. He could have more steals than PCA right now if he really wanted. He's pretty much already proven that. But it's not part of his game this year. And I think he's just going to focus on being the best hitter in the National League, which he has been pretty consistently over the last few years, and he will have the opportunity to do that. Now, it also helps that right now, again, we're zooming in this snapshot right now, and the Dodgers have lost six in a row, and they just got swept by the Cubs, and Ohtani still, we don't know when he's pitching again. So he's, you know, if you want to buy the dip on literally Shohei Ohtani, now would be a pretty good time to do that, I would say. Him, I don't know how many other opportunities you're going to have him not be the MVP favorite, but I do think that at the end of the season, the voter fatigue, like at this point, even the possibility that he won't win unanimously, which he has over and over, that alone is very compelling. And I do look forward to having more versions of this conversation over the next couple months, which is not always the case with MVP races. But I do think that this is a new flavor, a new genre of MVP discussion, which I am very much enjoying. So I think that that is a win for all of us talking about baseball for a living.
Other races that are happening in voting land, AL MVP, we'll just kind of fly through these. AL MVP right now is Yordan Alvarez's to lose, it feels like. He has been more productive than everybody else by a pretty significant margin at the plate. It's funny, right? Because Ohtani and PCA would both beat Yordan pretty handedly, I would say. But the league you're in, you don't really get to choose that. I mean, you kind of do, but you kind of don't. Yordan, kind of a tick above Bobby Witt Jr., Junior Caminero, Dylan Dingler. What a world. I think Cease and Schlittler will both get a lot of looks in the MVP race when it's all said and done. And they'll be the two guys going toe-to-toe in the Cy Young. Jordan, at this point, I think it's almost a toss-up between Cease and Schlittler.
Yeah, Cease has certainly trended more favorably over the last month than Schlittler. And we'll see, right? I think this was going to be a big question with Cam is just like, what does this look like over a full season? I mean, coming out of the gate that hot, throwing that hard, and he's not that he hasn't held that velocity, but especially compared to someone like Dylan Cease, who has come close to winning a Cy Young before, we know that workload is not an issue for him. I mean, that dude's going to show up and pitch, and I don't expect him to wear down. Now, he could have some outings where he walks a bunch of guys and has a clunker and the ERA takes a hit. But I mean, if you're looking at how this is trending and who you would kind of expect to have a stronger finish, I think Cease is going to be in really strong position here. As for MVP, I don't think either of them are going to be particularly relevant. And I will also say for AL MVP, you know, if you really had fun with the Cal versus Judge debate last year, you can have an even more niche version of it this year if you want to ride for Dylan Dingler, who is having an unbelievable season and is an incredible defensive catcher. But offensively, Yordan is completely in a league of his own. And I do feel like this feels like the Yordan season that we've all been waiting for, especially after not having him play much last year. It's been so nice to have him back hitting on a nightly basis and everyone recognize like, oh, yeah, this is a generational offensive talent that deserves to have one of these awards here. And so Dylan Dingler was amazing. And if he finishes second, that would be unbelievable and not even ridiculous at this point for him to finish ahead of Bobby Witt Jr. But I still think Yordan is like clearly ahead of everybody.
The Yordan thing, it's such a beautiful reminder that the Mount Rushmore of horrifying hitters to face in the sport, of like the four people that I believe have a legitimate argument to say they're the best hitter on the planet, are Ohtani, Judge, Juan Soto, and Yordan.
Yep, agreed. Like that is the group.
That's it.
And then it's a real drop-off, but I kind of do believe it's a real drop-off after those four. I mean, this year, Yordan's he's at a 194 WRC plus. Second right now among qualified hitters is Wilson Contreras at 158. I don't know, like, what was Judge at before he went down? I don't even think he was sniffing 190, at least this year.
No, he was slightly below
151.
Played through it.
Yeah.
He was playing through it for like the last month and he just wasn't hitting at all. So curious if Judge gets MVP votes. You know, you don't know how valuable this guy is until he's gone, man.
Yeah. And even Soto this year is at 159. So Yordan's just, he's in a league of his own in the way that Judge has been in recent years when he's won. So that's why I expect him to win. And that's certainly who I would vote for. Any other awards races before we take a break?
NL Cy Young, it really is Miz and Sanchez at this point. Chris Sale kind of lurking in the background. Zach Wheeler, if he gets enough innings, which I don't think he will. But the Miz-Sanchez debate is going to be so interesting because Miz's numbers are just better. Like, he on a rate basis, it's not even close. He's striking out the world. Yeah. He looks dominant. The ERA is microscopic. But there is an innings gap there where I think Sanchez ends up with at least a couple first-place votes, especially sure. if the Brewers decide to kind of limit Miz's innings down the stretch, which I don't think the Phillies will or can afford to do with Sanchez. So, like, if Sanchez ends up at 215 and Miz ends up at, like, 165, it's just going to look a lot like Zach Wheeler versus Corbin Burns 2021.
Yeah, and I will also mention, because there's probably some Yankees fans thinking, like, hey, that's not fair about Cam, because Schlittler is currently 13 innings ahead of Cease, because Cease did miss some time for, like, the first time in his career with injuries. So Cease does have to make up the gap there. I just bring that up because, yeah, the workload difference, and also who you're kind of banking on staying healthy, finishing strong, and amassing those innings. I think you certainly would take Sanchez over Miz, with all due respect, because, yeah, on a rate basis, I do think that it would not at all be surprising if, also appropriately, right, if it was Miz, that would again be a Brewer over a Philly. If it were, like, it would be the exact yeah. same thing if Miz ends up winning that in the same way that Burns did.
So my favorite thing about comparing these two guys, and I'm curious for how you would, like, take this into account if you were voting for it. Christopher Sanchez has a 336 BABIP. That is the highest number yeah. in the sport. So hitters, when the ball is in play, not over the fence, 336 batting average. Compare that to Miz, who is at 225, 100 points of batting average. Now, some of that certainly is batted ball quality, and I would imagine that it is very hard to hit a ball hard off Jacob Mizrowski. However, the Phillies defense freaking stinks, and the Brewers defense is really good. And so then you get into this conversation of, like, how much do you knock Sanchez for that versus how much do you give Miz credit for the BABIP? And that, to me, is a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, I agree. And that number was even higher earlier in the season, but he still had some weird ones. I will note, highest in the sport among qualified pitchers, non-Coors division. So yes. we should say that Michael Lorenzen and Kyle Freeland, those BABIPs are a little bit higher, but as we know, those are also way worse pitchers. So yeah, it is a weird one. I guess you could put that in Sanchez's favor, because process-wise, he's still pretty much doing everything you could possibly hope. He's throwing strikes, he's getting a lot of ground balls, and unfortunately, a lot of those have turned into hits. But I do think that both of these Cy Young races could end up being pretty compelling. And then Rookie of the Year, let's just be thorough. We will not be talking about Manager of the Year, because that is the
we don't believe in
favorite
it.
Award in sports. McGonagall, probably McGonagall's to lose. He is going to get MVP votes as well. So he's got a pretty substantial WAR lead. But man, I mean, the season Parker Messick is having, and that's another one where let's see how he finishes and kind of where Cleveland's at. And the hitter versus pitcher in the Rookie of the Year race has often been, again, it's different, right? Because an MVP, normally we push the pitcher to the side, you have your own award. Rookie of the Year, you are really comparing hitters versus pitchers in a much more significant way. We've seen way more pitchers win. It is much more common to see that. So that could end up being an interesting one. There are, of course, some other productive AL rookies. I still think McGonagall has a serious lead. Honestly, the NL is a little bit more interesting to me in terms of just... I like Weatherholt from a WAR standpoint is way ahead of everybody else because his defensive numbers have been so good. McLain has been good, but not necessarily as consistent as maybe we expected him to be. And then Carson Bench is making a push. Sal Stewart offensively still is going to have a really strong case. Is there anyone else in the NL that we should be thinking about?
I think Weatherholt wins this by a country mile at the end of the day.
Okay. All right. I mean, that's probably who I would vote for. But his counting stats right now are not standing out in a way that they were. So this will be a good test of WAR if you just sort it's like it's, you're not even thinking about it because he's so far ahead and he's playing great second base defense. But we'll see the kind of lead. Ben just kind of caught up to him. Stewart, of course, power numbers is way ahead. So, but I mean, you don't got to sell me on JJ Weatherholt. All right, let's take a break. When we return, your emails. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We are not that interesting, Jordan and I. In fact, you folks, you are the interesting ones. So we're going to let you talk here. Time for your emails.
All right. We are opening up the mailbag. Haven't done this in a while. You can email us baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Let's begin with an email from Gabe. This one came, actually, I believe this came before the deadline. So that is an important little nugget, but certainly relevant to our conversation that we had with Jeff Passant. Gabe said, "Hey, fellas, thanks for your hard work in the pods. Just took the bar. It was always a good distraction to have you guys in my ears." Man,
I would not listen to us. I would not listen to us when getting ready for the bar.
It's okay. All right. Gabe continues. Maybe I'm too cynical. Remember, this is before the deadline. Maybe I'm too cynical, but I think Scooble is going to the Dodgers, whether or not the Dodgers have the best offer on the table. What does Chris Illich, excuse me. What does Illich, he just says Illich, so that's my mistake. Gabe would not make that mistake. What does Illich care more about than getting a slightly better return for Scooble? Saving money. One of the best ways to ensure a salary cap is increasing animosity against the Dodgers on account of their inevitability. Sending Scooble there stokes the fire behind the cap movement even more. What's a slightly better retry on in the short term to Illich, return in the short term to Illich compared to the profits that he'll reap from his salary cap in the long run? I don't think the right line is Harris won't care about sending Scooble to the Dodgers, which is what we said on the podcast and turned out to be correct. I think it's, quote, Illich wants to send Scooble to the Dodgers. Maybe I'm too cynical. I would love to be wrong. Appreciate you guys. Cheers, Gabe.
So, Gabe, you were right about the facts, which is that Tarik Scooble is now on the Dodgers. The idea that a puppet master behind the scenes pushed Tarik Scooble from the Tigers to the Dodgers is not an idea unique to this email. I had multiple people around the sport more attuned to the conspiracy theory, tin foil hat side of things reach out to me and be like, there is no way this was by chance, right? The owners choreographed this to make everyone mad, right? No. I do think that maybe the Illich family who owns the Tigers was more willing to trade away Scooble knowing that there might be a new system coming up. I don't think copy and pasting him onto the Dodgers, plucking him like Roller Coaster Tycoon and dragging him over there to LA is what happened. I really don't. Maybe that will come out differently in time. You and I kind of stray on the non-conspiracy theory side of things. And what about this email that I really wanted to kind of touch on is how important really is the Dodgers' anger and frustration going to actually be when the union and the league gets into the room? Like if public sentiment is behind the league and their desire to put in a salary cap because of the Dodgers, that is a fact. How much impact is that really going to have? I don't know. I don't think we know, but I think it may be a little bit short-sighted to assume that it is just this fait accompli where if the Dodgers win the World Series, then we're getting a lockout or we're missing games or we're getting a cap.
Yeah. Well, right. And I made that. I think I was pretty consistent about that after Scooble happened. I know we didn't react. We didn't have like a whole pod on Scooble the day after because of just the timing. But I certainly disagree with like, oh, now we're having a lockout. Oh, now we're missing games because they got Tarik Scooble. Do I think that, yes, this contributes to their chances of winning the World Series? And I do. And to what you're bringing up, how that would impact the likelihood of not likelihood, but just like public sentiment, the feeling around it, whose side you're on. I've made this point all season long and I'll continue to do it. I do think that it would change the tone if it's a Rays Brewers World Series versus if the Dodgers, you know, romp through October again and Scooble throws three perfect games. So now back to the email. I think, yeah, dude, I went on a Toronto podcast earlier this week and they were referencing apparently Whit Merrifield, an actual player, was coming out here and saying that that's what he believes is happening. It's like, okay, well, I guess my point when they brought that up to me and they were like, oh, do you buy this? I was like, okay, the outcome could maybe assist in the messaging, as you said, but I just, that is really a level of like, and we talked about this a lot, because what you're really implying beyond the messages is that the front offices and all the prospect discussions, that all of that is just a farce, and that at the end of the day, the front offices in both sides, because it also, you could also say that, oh, it involves the Brewers, and the Brewers were saying, no, let him go to the Dodgers, because that will help our case for these things, or the Rays saying, let him go to the Dodgers, but I just, if you think that that's how those front offices are operating, and that I just, I'm sorry, yeah. I'm not there. So
I just don't think that we're at that level of blatant collusion. That is not the world I want to live in. And therefore, yeah, I am going to be maybe a little bit, maybe not naive, but I am going to believe in what I am being told, at least as it pertains to this particular topic. Let's keep moving on with another conspiracy theory about Tarek Skubal. This is from Ben, who may or may not have played college baseball with me. Ben says, hey guys, call me crazy, but the Tigers come out of the big... This is so funny. Hey guys, call me crazy, but the Tigers come out as big winners of the Skubal trade. Great start. One, Skubal lost his first start as a Dodger. He is clearly cooked. Two, the Tigers wanted to pay him $19 million an hour versus the $32 million he ended up with. The day they traded him was about 69% of the way through the season, prorating his full salary. The Tigers ending up paying him $22 million, much closer to their number. The Tigers knew they weren't going to be very good anyway, so I believe they might stick around and go for it as part of an elaborate ruse to get the rest of that bloated contract off the books while also building for the future. To the Tigers playing 3D chess, fleece the L6 Dodgers, please discuss. Galaxy brain.
Well, they weren't the L6 Dodgers when they fleeced them, but it sure ages well for the purposes of this email. I will say that if we are going to take any element of this email from our pal Ben seriously whatsoever, I am very intrigued by the arbitration element of this and how different, like how much that changed all of this, how much it changes trade value, how much it changed, because it's a huge difference. And I almost wonder, you know, how much, now I hope that how much more money he was making was not a factor for some of these other teams contemplating acquiring him. But who knows? I do wonder how much that impacted his trade value. And Skubal himself talked about how that sort of impacted his own relationship with the front office. But I do think that the arbitration plot point intrigues me. Now, whether that means they were trying to salary dump him, I don't think. Not really.
Think about it.
Not really buying that.
The Dodger era Skubal, the Skubal era Dodgers have not won a baseball game.
They haven't. Skubal has only lost. Meanwhile, the Tigers are one
flying
game
high.
Out.
One game out. One game out.
So, oh boy, River Ryan postseason start in Detroit. Maybe I'll be there.
It's gonna hit.
It'll be pretty lit.
Tigers Dodgers
honestly,
World
what,
Series.
What? Well. Let's. We don't. Might not even. Well, yes. That. Sorry. That's max. That's maximum chaos. Let's just remind everybody that end of this month, the Dodgers will be in Detroit. And I really hope, of course, we're hoping that Skubal is lined up to pitch in those games. I mean, I'm going to be there regardless. I just hope River Ryan's hamstring is feeling good. And I hope Zaire Hope keeps hitting home runs like he did last night in Double A, and we could just get the full thing. Let's just call Brady Smith up to be in the bullpen. I mean, the Tigers bullpen could use some help. Let's do it all in August. Let's continue with the Skubal emails.
Yes,
this
I got this one.
Comes from Peter. Go ahead.
Peter says, hi, Jake and Jordan. Don't know if you saw, but Tarek Skubal got traded to the Dodgers. You catch that?
Nice. I saw it. Yep.
I was reading reactions and was struck by this line from Jesse Rogers at ESPN, quote, some in the NL might just roll the dice. and head into the postseason as is, and then hope for a salary cap next year and a more even playing field. Peter asks, do you think any front offices actually think this way? And if so, why are they working in pro sports with such a loser mentality? Sure, I was annoyed that the Dodgers got the best guy again, but come on. The Blue Jays, who I love, just took the Dodgers to extra innings in Game 7 when they started a Max Scherzer with no thumbs. And no one in the NL even wants to try this year? As much as I'm annoyed by the Dodgers, I'm most annoyed that we have to hear more of this BS from other teams, Peter. Do I think people believe this, Jordan? Do I think that there are front office members that have this mentality? Absolutely. I absolutely believe that. And that sucks and is a legitimate problem with our sport. Like 100,000% an issue. The jocks versus nerds debate as it pertains to front offices in all sports is tired. This is an example, and maybe I'm going to sound toxic. This is an example, in my opinion, of like the people that believe this either didn't compete at a high level, didn't play, aren't wired that way. And those types of people, like, yes, their perspectives on the sport and their intelligence like makes teams better over the long run because they're more sustainable and they're doing these smart things. I do agree this is a huge loser mentality. Do I believe that any general manager, that any Pobo believes this? I do not. That I do not believe. I think that the type of person it takes to be driven, to be good, to be about this life to that extent, that such that you can run a club, I think the loser mentality kind of gets weeded out. Now, there are people under them, maybe, that believe some of these things that are like, we don't have a shot, let's just punt for next year. But if you're running a team, you are like so hyper-competitive that I would be floored if any top exec actually believed this and acted upon it.
Yeah, I think my like edit, I mean, I'm not trying to change your take because sure. You can believe whatever you want to believe, but to this premise of, oh, we don't have a chance, let's just hope we get a salary cap and then it's more fair. I mean, that's a pretty extreme take. To me, the thing I have been thinking about a lot, though, and I think is maybe more along the lines of what you're getting at, and I sort of alluded to this when we talked about Scooble on the trade deadline special, which is that how the Dodgers expect to be in October, so they are solely focused on winning the World Series and essentially doing whatever they need to do to increase their championship probability, right? That they are like, the default is we're in October, now what can we do to make it more likely that we win it all? I do think that that is a contrast to a lot of front offices, as we know, some of whom have admitted publicly, who are solely focused on getting in and seeing what happens. And I think that is also a distinction. And you could say that is exactly why the Brewers and Rays didn't trade for Tarek Skubal. But you could also say that is exactly why the Brewers and Rays should trade for Tarek Skubal, because they have accomplished, certainly the Brewers, the Rays, we know it's been less consistent recently. But if you just focus on this year, and certainly with Milwaukee recently, they have technically already achieved, like the Dodgers, the floor of we are in the postseason. So you would think that that would be a team that would be like, okay, we're there. We've never won the World Series. What can we do to increase the chances that we can now win the World Series? And instead, it seems that the focus still always defaults to, we want to make sure that we can continue to be good all the time. And that might mean keeping prospect X, keeping young pitcher X, because that is the important thing to ensure that we remain, that our floor remains
high. Giving ourselves a chance every year.
Even if we are never chasing the ceiling of what the Dodgers are doing, which is just like, all right, if you guys don't want this 5-WAR player or the best closer in the sport or the best free agent available or the best player on the trade market, or we're just going to do that because that's where we're shopping. And if you guys aren't willing to beat these prices, whether it's in free agents or a trade, then that's what we're going for. That's what we're trying. So that's where we give the Dodgers credit. We know there's a lot involved in the other advantages that we've covered at length, and that's not irrelevant. But I think the mentality, which is what we're focused on here, I do think that there's something to that, more so in that respect, in terms of just like, let's just get in and see what happens. I think that's the distinction more than saying we have no chance. But let's not try. Let's hope that the league makes it easier for us.
but part of the rise of the nerds is that the nerds are often right. And that the teams in our sport of the last 15 years, this was more of a thing like 5-10 years ago, the teams that were kind of clinging on to the old world of having like an athlete at the top of the hierarchy, like that kind of got chipped away, where like being hyper aggressive and emotional is actually often a detriment. If you're that's a different skill set. And so I'm trying to hold both of these things in my head just to answer that question. Do some front offices have a loser mentality? I would say that there are some people in some front offices that have some aspects of what you might call a loser mentality.
Yes.
Am I hedging there 100,000%? You are onto something. I think it operates a little differently than how you posed it, Peter, in terms of like the salary cap as the savior. I don't think that teams think about it that way. I really like front offices. In talking to people in front offices about the upcoming labor situation, the overwhelming sentiment that I've gotten is, I don't care what the new structure is. Once they put the new CBA on my desk on March 14th or April 8th or whatever, I will read it, I will learn it, and I will do my best to win under it. And I do, maybe owners want the cap. Obviously, they do. Owners want the cap.
Not maybe.
I don't think that Pobos, like, I don't think Eric Neander, who runs the Rays, is sitting at his desk, twiddling his thumbs, looking at his watch and being like, ooh, can't wait for the cap. Like, that's not how, like I said, the top dogs operate. The top dogs that run these teams don't think about the sport that way. Two more emails before we get out of here. Danielle, with a very long, passionate email about the Washington Nationals. I'm going to do my best to summarize this. Hi, Jake and Jordan. Huge fan of you guys for a long time and through many different iterations. Shouts out to DAZN. I don't know about that. I wanted to share some thoughts that I have about the Washington Nationals deadline activities and how I feel a little bit unmoored and maybe a little bit crazy right now. First off, I think the Nats should have tried to go for the third wild card, and they should have done the Pirates approach of just acquiring a bunch of relievers and hoping that some of them are an upgrade from what they currently have. I would have chopped off my own arm for Luke Weaver to be the closer. Danielle, I appreciate the passion. Great example of why emotion is maybe not always the best thing when running a baseball team, as the Nats have lost quite a number of ball games recently and are now 5.5 back in the picture. Is that because they've traded away Curtis Meade and all these other players? Maybe, perhaps. I think, Jordan, you and I agree that the Nats, as constructed, not good enough to make the playoffs. Danielle continues, I think most of my frustration with the Nats is rooted in the previous regime, but we are currently staring down 7 years of no postseason baseball and general irrelevancy in the larger baseball world. I'm happy about the improvements Toboni and the new front office have made, but I know that the starting point was pretty bleak. I want someone to genuinely answer me why I should care. The Nats traded away three of their top five players at the deadline, maybe even came close to trading a fourth. We are objectively a worse team than we were 2 weeks ago. I am sick and tired of being a feeder team every year at the deadline. I keep getting a nagging feeling in my brain that CJ Abrams and James Wood will never take a postseason at bat for the Washington Nationals. I can only take so many years of this, and everyone is telling me to be patient, and that's making me feel insane. Why should I accept mediocrity year after year? Why should I go to games? Why should I ever buy a jersey for a player again? Will Toboni ever convince owner Mark Lerner to spend a dollar on a free agent? Like, legitimately, what am I doing? Not really sure what I was going for in all of this, but wanted to share my thoughts with you guys and let you know how I'm feeling, Danielle. Danielle, I apologize for summarizing slightly. Time is of the essence. This sentiment, to me, is so much more powerful than the Dodgers are ruining the sport. And I think that it is unique to certain fan bases and certain teams. The notion that the league has tried to push that small market teams cannot extend their superstars is such a farce and so moored from reality. Connor Griffin, JJ Weatherholt, Julio Rodriguez, like Jackson Churio, if you are aggressive and you spend the money on a player at the right time, you can extend superstars. Samuel Basayo in Baltimore. I know that there are examples of players that leave. The number of players that are sticking around now is bigger than it has ever been. Bobby Witt Jr. in Kansas City. As a result, free agent classes have gotten very weak. We will start to see that as the best players in the sport are under these long-term contracts. The Nats feel to me like a bit of a unique case. because this franchise has had some of the best players in the world. Juan Soto, Bryce Harper, Trey Turner, Max Scherzer, slightly different category. Steven Strasburg, slightly different category. Anthony Rendon. And none of those elite players starred in their 30s for the Nats. I guess Scherzer was a free agent acquisition, different case. But of all the homegrown stars, really it's Turner, Soto, Rendon, and Harper. Like, that is legitimate fan trauma that should cloud your perspective on James Wood and CJ Abrams.
Right. And, you know, you got Ryan Zimmerman, but other than that, this is not a franchise with the rich history. But it, with that short history, to have that many incredible talents come through and to not really be able to hold on to them when, right, there's so many other examples. Yeah. And I think that, I mean, yeah, we cut this email down, but, like, she hits on a lot of other points and doesn't not mention the Dodgers once, right? You know, she also talks about the uncertainty of next year and how that is dispiriting, especially considering the state of the organization and just like the state of the competitive window for them. But I'm totally with you. I think that, like, these are the, not that we've also gotten emails from people being like, how is my team going to win? How are they ever going to beat the Dodgers? I'm tired of this. And I respect that perspective too. We understand that fans in different markets are going to feel different kinds of ways, but I agree with you that, to her point, what is the point of, and this is related to the Adley Rutschman thing, the same thing where it's like,
yeah,
okay, if we're going to lose a billion games and draft Adley Rutschman, Adley Rutschman better be here when we do something successful, interesting, relevant, whether he extends long-term, let's accomplish something with him. Same thing. If you're going to trade Juan Soto, you kind of nailed it, but what are you going to do with James Wood and CJ Abrams right here?
For what?
For what? For what? Exactly. And Mackenzie Gore's already gone. Okay, you're going to say, well, look what Gavin Fien is, right? Like, okay, sure. There's some truth to some of that. And if they trade CJ Abrams, in front office speak, you can keep pushing it and be like, this is still about the Soto trade. But it's at some point, we need to tangibly grasp onto something, right? And that is these players in your team's uniforms winning baseball games.
And as to Boney defender number one, I don't think that that is on his shoulders yet. I think it would have been short-sighted to try and make this particular team into a contender at the deadline. I do not think that this Nats team is good enough to make the playoffs or make noise in the playoffs. I think that is a fact. I understand that there is an element of the fan base that wants just to see someone put the chips in. Guess what? That just wasn't really ever going to happen under Toboni. This all falls on Lerner. It falls on ownership.
Yeah.
To spend the money to extend Abrams or Wood. Once that happens, they will get a lot more leash. Those players are worth it. And I am also skeptical it will happen. It is the number one biggest question facing this franchise in the next 3 years. It's not even close.
Yeah, I agree. And that is where the Toboni conversation is hard because of the timing. And who am I to tell Danielle? Like, she's right. It has been a long time of being bad and not relevant. And Toboni's only been there for not even a year. But he does, even though I agree with a lot of his decision-making so far, he does still harbor that burden to a degree, but I think you're totally right in still centering it on ownership and those larger decisions that are probably above his head.
And I think the fact that he didn't trade CJ Abrams is, one, a testament to what this organization has already accomplished this season, and two, a recognition on Toboni's part that, you know, you can't handle your business that way, right? He had a quote earlier this year where he was like, I understand that this fan base has gone through a lot, and I probably need to be better about taking that in, though it is difficult for me because I was not here, right?
Yeah.
All of these things exist simultaneously. Let's do one more and then we'll get out of here. P-Core Armstrong, does he believe in Babe Ruth? This is from Justin. Okay, I know this is far from the most relevant thing happening post-trade deadline, but why are all these players suddenly talking about Babe Ruth didn't exist? Like, I know this generation is beyond cooked, but this is something that Gen Z players actually believe, or are they just massive trolls? Please drop the obviously fake lore on why this even started for the uninitiated, Justin. The bit that Babe Ruth's not real is so funny. It's so funny because he's obviously real. Let's get this straight. P-Core Armstrong thinks Babe Ruth exists. He went on a podcast. Someone asked, what's an unpopular opinion you have? He said, one that I really like is that Babe Ruth wasn't real. Clearly, PCA understands that Babe Ruth existed. Okay. that is a smart person. I don't think he is that duped by, you know, the conspiracy theories of this regard. I think it's funny. I think it's funny to say that Babe Ruth didn't exist.
Yeah. And there's like a, this is a classic, this is a very modern case of just like this clip. He is retelling a different podcast and then the clip gets recirculated with a certain caption. And so it just gets distorted in so many different ways, but it's like, wait, PCA said what? Very click hole. This literally is like, could be a click hole headline. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I will say, I do think that like you are Justin is getting it at a very basic concept that is more broad, which is Gen Z's troll proclivity. And so like, yep. I wouldn't put it past PCA to like push this even further just because he thinks it's funny. But no, I'm with you. I don't think this is a real thing. So not concerned.
You know, will this impact his MVP case? Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth is not a real thing. My favorite part of this entire fake fiasco is Chris Russo, the mad dog, going on First Take and like yelling at PCA to like respect Babe Ruth and what he accomplished, as if Mad Dog saw Babe Ruth play. It's like, you need to understand what I grew up watching. Babe Ruth was incredible. It's like, dog, you were born in the 60s. Like, you don't remember Babe Ruth. I still agree.
Gotta stand up for George.
I believe that, yeah, like, could I strike out Babe, like Jake Mintz? Could current Jake Mintz get Babe Ruth out right now? Yeah, I believe that. I do. You also need to just celebrate Babe Ruth for what he accomplished in his era, right?
Hmm. I mean, yeah, I think the debates about like how terrible the player Babe Ruth would be in 2026, that is way more fun than saying he's not.
Could you imagine Babe Ruth getting a glance at PCA? They would burn PCA at the stake, okay? in 1925, they'd be like, who is this alien man running so quick, so swiftly?
Yeah. Yeah, what part of his game would be most like, whoa, what's going
Why
on
Why is
here?
He trying to hit it high in the pull side? What's he doing?
That's the real question.
What are those tattoos?
You know who's doing that pretty well?
Prison?
Babe Ruth.
Babe Ruth.
Babe Ruth's pull air percentage was ridiculous. All right, we're going to take a break. When we return, it's Friday. A quick good, the bad, the ugly before we get out of here.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jordan, literally in the last 3 seconds in my head, maybe PCA saying Babe Ruth's not real is actually like a under-the-radar dig at Ohtani for the MVP stuff.
Ooh. Well, wait, but wouldn't that make Ohtani's case even stronger? Because then we couldn't even say, since Babe Ruth. Just say.
Right. Since
never,
never.
This has literally never happened in any form. Interesting thought. All right, it's Friday. Let's do it. The good, the bad, the ugly.
My good this week is that White Sox Red Sox game last night, awfully crazy. I'm glad we taped it. The 8th straight win for the Boston Red Sox. They came back last night from deficits in the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, and 13th.
I mean, wait, weren't they also down earlier in the game? Maybe not. Yeah, I mean, they did.
It's like, what did we do with this? What do we do with this team? This is why this was particularly good. I don't believe Contreras played last night.
Didn't play. He's the only one that didn't play.
Their best hitter did not play, and they scored 12 runs. Their lineup last night was Sogard, Rafaela, Abreu, Division III legend Caleb Durbin in the four hole, Yoshida, who was removed for Jamai Jones, Monasterio, the ghost of Jaren Duran, Anthony Siegler, and Connor Wong, who was then replaced by Jake Rogers. They scored 12 runs. The Boston Red Sox are incredible. What a wagon. They're 26-3 since July 3rd. I don't know what to do with them. I've never seen a baseball team play this well for this long. It just doesn't happen. Are they peaking too early? We're thinking about, don't care. Last night was just the epitome of a great regular season ball game. And I'm glad I was locked in basically from the fifth inning on.
Yeah, I think I tuned in the 10th and still got a whole lot of baseball. So that was really something. And you, although here's a take, ready for this? I actually came out of that game like feeling better about the White Sox. I was kind of like, you know what? This team, I would love to see. I believe that the Red Sox are 6-0 against the White Sox this year. Would love to see this rematch in October. I don't know. I haven't thought about what that would look like in the bracket, whatever. I'm just saying this was fun. I would happily watch it again. And I was still impressed with the Chicago effort there. Let's go to my good. And that's another team that swept this week. I'm sorry, am I reading this right? The New York Mets completed their first road sweep of the season here in Cleveland, Ohio, where I was in the building for the first couple of these. The second game of this series was certainly in the running for craziest game of the week until the White Sox and Red Sox said, all right, that was nice. Watch this. But what an absurd ball game we had on Wednesday. I won't go through all of the major hits there, but the one that you certainly saw was Jeffrey Yan making his major league debut. And the fact that I was in the building for this was a kind of a surreal moment. The fact when once they called him up after they made all the trades, they empty out their bullpen at the deadline. And it's like, oh my God, Jeffrey Yan, he's striking out 45% of AAA hitters. He's going to come up. I mean, this guy got on our radar 3 years ago, 4 years ago when
tell
he
people
was in
why.
The Marlins system. Well, I don't think, I think tell by now people have probably noticed, seen the clip. Jeffrey Yan.
He jumps.
Once he got, this is someone who was in the Angel system like 10 years ago, gets released, is out of baseball. He's living in Arizona.
He's working on roofing.
He's delivering refrigerators. He's doing food delivery. He's doing all these things. And on the side, he's playing like rec league in Arizona. And he just keeps his dream alive. He's got one heck of a left arm. The Marlins sign him in 21. At some point during his Marlins stint, he develops this celebration where when he strikes anybody out, doesn't even need to end the inning, he leaps in the air. He lands in essentially a near splits and kind of gives it some spice on the back end of the leap towards the heavens. It's one of the most incredible celebrations we've ever seen. He does it all the time. He does it every strikeout. Does not matter what the situation is, what the score is, what the, you know, how, who's on base, all these things. He then does it in the Dominican Winter League. He gets released. He goes to Japan. He goes, signs with the Rockies. He's in AAA with the Rockies for like all of 2024, or sorry, all of last year. He was with the Rockies in AAA, never gets called up. The Mets sign him in February. And the velo ticked up even more. He was like 97, 98 with Miami. Now he is just cruising at 100 with a ridiculous slider. His command is obviously not very good, but this is some of the best left-handed stuff in the world. And I just can't believe I was there to watch this. It was so cool. And then to just watch him be in the clubhouse before his debut, after his debut, smiling as much as anyone you'll ever see in a major league clubhouse when you consider his journey. He's 29 years old. And now just to think about like the fact that because he is throwing 100, is this the beginning of the Jeffrey Yan story? I mean, it's absurd to say that, but it's just like there is a real opportunity here for him to be an impact major league reliever. And I'm just so fascinated to sure. I mean, it's already an amazing story, but I just can't wait to see what happens next.
He's also a wonderful litmus test for what type of fan you are. Like if you see him jumping on the mound and you get angry, like, I wish you the best. I understand, like, there's an element of this that's, like, feels goofy and feels banana ball-y, especially on a crappy Mets team where it's, like,
you were
supposed to win 93 games and now you've brought this circus act into the proceedings. I understand that. However, just enjoy this. It's ridiculous. It's hilarious. Yes. He is jumping so high. This is not a little leap. He is getting in the air. Okay. Who cares if it matters or not? Who cares if he gets clobbered? If he gets clobbered and looks stupid, that's funny too. So all right. I have to say is, like, I would encourage people to view this with like a joyous lens. Now, frustrated Mets fans, I get it, but for everyone else, like, just like it.
I agree everything you said, totally with you. I will also say that yes, none of this excuses the Mets season that they had have had that resulted in trading away their whole pitching staff. But I wrote you can read just my check-in with the Mets, like, not that Jeffrey Yan is going to make them all, but like, they are now going to be playing for the rest of the season with, and I'm not just saying this because they just swept Cleveland. Like, you could already sense this once the deadline was behind them. That had just been following them around for the last month. They were all just this trudge towards the inevitable of everyone's about to get traded. This was a failure of a season. And now I think they're just going to have a good time because they still have a lot of good players. They've got young players like Benjamin Ewing. They've got players like Bichette and Polanco and Lindor who are trying to at least show that they can still be good major leaguers. Some of these players are trying to prove that they belong in the Mets next year. Some of them are trying to prove that they belong in the big leagues at all. And then Jeffrey Yan is just having a damn good time through it and could be a real part of their bullpen next year. So I do think that this team has now, I will say it is important that they don't win too many games because of the draft ramifications of that. But we'll move that to the side for now and just say that I think that this Mets team is truly going, and by the way, that's a real thing that Mets are going to have to think about. But I do think that this team is going to be totally fine for the rest of the season. Their pitching staff is going to have nights where it does not go well, but I do think that they're actually going to be completely reasonable. They're going to play big time spoiler with the Phillies, with the Braves, with the Subway Series in the middle of September. I do think the Mets are going to have fun ruining some other team's seasons. I really think that is going to happen.
The Orioles go there in September, which means we get Pete Alonso crying. It's going to be an interesting last couple of months for the New York Mets. My bad this week has nothing to do with the Mets. Let's scoot on out to the San Francisco Giants. Harrison Bader is not playing because he ran a scooter into the back of a fire truck and it ran over his foot like an idiot. The Giants are making fun of him, which is so funny. Daniel Susak hit a double this week and did the scooter celebration. What is the scooter celebration? He kind of like revved his, like held his hands up and like kicked his foot back. And Jordan, the reason this is bad is that like, I don't know, man.
We haven't even talked about the fact that, because this news came out right after we talked about it the first time, that the Giants are like trying to not pay him. I think you like referred to it when we first had the conversation that this is something that could maybe, you know, result in his salary being withheld. But I not that I didn't take that totally seriously, but it sounds like the Giants are truly trying to not pay Harrison Bader, at least this season, which is, you know, amidst all these other disasters. So I don't know. I think this is bad too. It is funny. I appreciate it. Does this indicate that they don't think that they're just making fun of Harrison Bader and we were never going to see him on the Giants again? Like, or is they're just trying to make light of a miserable situation? I just don't know.
I don't know either, because I don't think like Harrison Bader is on the road with them. It's not as if they've gotten the chance to like banter about this with him. If I'm Harrison Bader, this is not funny.
Right.
So for me, it is funny that they think it's funny now. It's a little bit hashtag too soon.
I don't know what to make of it, but I do think it's closer to bad than good. All right, my bad is closer to ugly than bad, but it's definitely not good. Kevin Gausman's on the Cubs now, and the Cubs played the Blue Jays yesterday. Kevin Gausman was maybe going to start that game, and then he got pushed back, maybe because he didn't want to pitch against them. He gave an interesting quote being like, yeah, it would have been nice. Like, that would have been a lot, which is, I was like, yeah, Kevin Gausman, real emotional attachment to Toronto. He also gave this quote. He was on the Cubs broadcast. And this is both very funny and very unfortunate. He said he was talking about the transition and his family getting adjusted to being on the Cubs. And Kevin Gausman said this, quote, you know, it's funny. My 5-year-old, after the first game here, where the Cubs blew out the Dodgers, was kind of poking me a little bit and said, you know, I like the Cubs. They can beat the Dodgers. It was kind of a stab in the heart a little bit, because right after she said the Blue Jays couldn't. So that was a tough moment.
Oh,
I like Kevin Gausman a lot.
To be fair,
and
the Blue Jays beat the Dodgers three times.
So do the Cubs. This is very funny, very adorable. Kids say the darndest things. Did Kevin Gausman have to reveal this to endear himself to the Cubs fans? I don't know.
I'm happy he revealed this. This is fascinating.
I am too. It is fascinating. It is funny. I'm not mad at the kid. And I'm not taking this too seriously. Kevin Gausman is still going to be loved forever in Toronto. But this is a special case of a little bit. Both of our bads, a hint of too soon. Just a hint of too soon.
My ugly this week is Phillies president of baseball operations, Dave Dombrowski, who traded for Luis Arraez, which is a good thing. But part of the reason that the Phillies reshuffled their entire defensive alignment was to accommodate Alec Bohm. Alec Bohm, who will be a free agent at season's end. Alec Bohm, who has not been particularly good. In a recent article from friend of the program, Matt Gelb over at The Athletic, Dombrowski quoted as saying, quote, "Well, he's also got close to 60 RBIs and 13 or 14 homers. I know frustrations can rise when you see it, but it was a good point from one of our scouts. When you see a player every day, you have a tendency to look at their downside. But if you compare his numbers, how many guys have more RBIs than Bohm does? That's an important part of the club. So we think he's a good player." End quote. Bohm entered the day ranked 146th out of 150 qualified position players in Fangraphs WAR. The reason this is ugly is that Dave Dombrowski referencing RBI in as like a reason to keep Alec Bohm in 2026. Like, does Dave Dombrowski believe that? Like, or is he just like, they've ended up with Alec Bohm on the roster still, and so they need to justify that reality. And he was like, you know what would be a good way to do it? RBI.
To answer his question, 42 players have more RBI than Alec Bohm.
It's a lot of players.
But I think Mr. Gelb is more on top of the more relevant metric, which is that he is bottom 10 in all of baseball in Fangraphs WAR.
The funniest part of this to me, and the reason why it is truly ugly, is that it made me think about the person that heard this quote from Dombrowski or read this quote from Dombrowski and was like, you know what? Great point.
Alec Bohm
does rack up RBI. Like a more old school Phillies fan who is like Bohm agnostic and then heard the RBI claim and is like, get me a jersey. I'm in.
Alec Bohm has spent most of the year hitting fourth or fifth. If you're hitting fourth or fifth behind Schwarber and Harper, the RBIs are just going to kind of happen. If you're just,
yes,
like that's kind of how that's going to work. So, also a wonderful transition to my ugla, which is Eagles defensive coordinator Vic Fangio being asked about the Luis Arraez trade. And Luis Arraez, so Fangio, do you know anything about Fangio? Who cares? Point is, Eagles, you get the point. Eagles coach asked about the Phillies. And he's basically like, Luis Arraez, he'll improve. He basically said, I'm paraphrasing, he'll improve the offense. The defense is going to be pretty interesting. Then he pauses and then just swerves into this next quote, which is so funny. Quote, you see some of these other guys? I mean, Nick Castellanos, Matt Strom, Harrison Bader, Taiwan Walker. Man, Rob Thompson did a hell of a job with managing those guys through to the playoffs last year. Okay, so a couple things here. Couple things here.
Yeah.
There's a lot of directions we could go here. So the first thing that's so funny and ugly is that, again, he unprompted, right? He's asked about Arraez, and he just goes out of his way to seemingly defend his pal, Rob Thompson. Oh, my God, look what he managed to manage his team. The examples that he gives, though, are so funny, right? Castellanos, Strom, Bader, Walker. So none of them are around anymore. But,
yes.
As I think you'll probably point out, Bader was awesome. Strong was really good last year. And I don't know if he's still paying attention to him on the Royals, but what do you make of this? It's just so funny and so ugly. Just such a strange diversion.
So what you have here is a Venn diagram. One circle is bad at baseball. The other one is tough to be around. Nick or Castellanos both. Is, or, well, that's what I'm going to say. Nick Castellanos is the only one of this quartet that was both bad at baseball and tough to be around last year. I don't think Bader is really either. I think that he has made a number of questionable decisions throughout his career. However, he is well-liked within the game. Like, people like having him around. As a teammate for 2 months is the perfect way to experience Harrison Bader. 2 months, and then he's not on your team is kind of, that's great. Perfect. So he doesn't belong here. Taijuan Walker was just bad at baseball and was, by all accounts, really kind of wonderful and handled it well, whereas Matt Strom was the opposite, where he was getting outs but, like, pissing off everyone with the Phillies all the time. And so that is what I love about this, is that in reality, none of these players are like any of these other players. They all present different examples. Right. And maybe that is the compliment to Rob Thompson, that all these different weird things Rob Thompson had to deal with, he handled it until he did it.
Yeah. So, and I don't know if this is just like it's just so strange. It's so strange. And that's why it's an ugly. So, doesn't mention Bohm, but I guess Bohm's still around, and there's a chance that, like, Vic Fangio is, like, at the game. He doesn't want to, like, he clearly went out of his, you know, he wanted to make, but it is funny because, you know, that's still a problem. All right. That is the end of this episode of Baseball Barbercast.
Looking ahead. Yeah. There's going to be baseball this weekend. They're going to play again. They're playing more games this weekend. A couple of highlights. Max Fried, first ever start tonight against the Braves. He will be pitching for the Yankees tonight against the Braves at Yankee Stadium. That's kind of saucy. Sale against Cole tomorrow night. That's probably the premier series of the weekend. Can the Red Sox keep it going? Orioles-Rangers is sneaky important for the AL wildcard standings that are more confusing than, you know, an astrophysics textbook. We've got the Pirates hosting the Mets. The Pirates are beneath the Reds now in the NL wildcard race.
Oh.
That is an embarrassment. The Dodgers have an L6. The Mariners are doing a 50th anniversary weekend that might end with Dan Wilson not having a job anymore. Maybe kind of a just, who knows? The Mariners are just such an embarrassment. I really can't believe
Mariners
how bad it's gotten.
Oh, my God.
Meanwhile, Detroit Tigers are just one game out. They're one game back. It's going to be a great weekend of ball, Jordan. What are you going to be locked into?
And the Mariners are 1.5 games back, so it's not like they're dead. They just look dead most of the time. I mean, Cleveland and Chicago, the Guardians also had a terrible week getting swept by the Mets. If they sweep the White Sox, they'll be back in first place. So anything is possible in the American League. If you want to go check out some ball this weekend, make sure you use the Game Time app. Go watch some baseball. I will be at a wedding tomorrow, so I will not be watching any baseball in person, but maybe one of these games will catch my attention during the reception. Congratulations, Jack and Shelby. Otherwise,
if you're in Miami,
thank you all for listening.
If you're in Miami or St. Louis, got the Rockies coming in St. Louis. Game Time out. Tap in. Could see some wins.
Hey, I bet you could find some nice tickets on the Game Time app for Angels Marlins. And Marlins, bad week, back at 500, still in it, because everyone is still in it except, I guess, the Angels and the Rockies. Thank you to Carter Singh and Ross Tudor for producing this episode of Baseball Barbercast. Andrew Hart's enjoying some time off, well deserved. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com, and we will be back on Monday. See ya.